good people. We would still see her all the time, walking the road between the Moonstone where she worked and her sister's place, but Sissy was never much for small talk. We thought she was on the rude side of things when we first met her. We imagined that maybe she was holding a grudge against the young family who barged into her home and took over. But once we got to know Sissy, we began to understand that this was just her way. She didn't have a lot to say. After we moved in, she still came around, flipped the fuse switch when the power blew, jiggled the toilet just so when it wouldn't flush, even would bring overflow of firewood and kindling from her place to our porch in the winters. The one time I tried to pay her for cleaning the gutters, she turned her back on me and walked away. As a kid, Will was mesmerized by Sissy. It's understandable. She was over 6 feet tall and had a long black braid with silver streaks the size of an anaconda. For a little guy, she was an absolute giant. The summer we moved in, Will offered to help her clean the rooms at the Moonstone, and she said sure. He'd asked our permission, and we just expected she'd say no. But when he came back from across the road and said he'd be back in a few hours, we couldn't go back on our word. She paid him a buck each day. He was 10 years old, scrubbing toilets and making beds and hauling garbage. Of course, he soon began to give us cleaning lessons. Among other things, he showed us the secret to creasing hospital corners when making a bed, and how to fold and hang towels properly. We'd ask him what he and Sissy talked about. "Oh, nothing," he'd say. "Sissy doesn't talk." Funny that a restless kid like Will never got impatient with that silence of hers. He was precocious, a talkative boy full of questions and opinions. To be honest, it's impossible to imagine the two of them in the Moonstone rooms, him emptying waste paper baskets and putting new rolls of toilet paper in the dispensers, and Sissy scrubbing the tubs and vacuuming. But the two were quite a pair, and it lasted on and off until the summer Will turned 13, when he began to become interested in the Quinault, the Native American tribe that had an active and large reservation up the beach. After that summer, he spent most of his time getting involved in any way he could on the reservation. He did anything they asked. He scraped and painted garages, the canoe sheds, their houses. A guy there named Joe Chenwa, an elder, took a shine to Will and told him he'd spend 1 hour teaching him canoe carving for every week he worked on the reservation. Joe led Will to be interested in the law. Joe had been instrumental in the 80s in leading the fight to reclaim thousands of acres of Quinault land. He wasn't a lawyer, but he was an organizer and an activist, a leader, and he became expert in Native American laws. Joe was Will's hero. And when he died of lung cancer in the fall of Will's freshman year in college, Will flew back to Seattle and drove down the coast to the memorial. We'd sold the house by then, and it was the first time Will would stay at the Moonstone as a guest. Moonstone Beach, Moclips, and the history of the area were always more important to Will than they were to the rest of us. He'd read books on the massacres and the government land steals, and tell us the stories with tears in his eyes. On the reservation they called him Little Cedar, a name Joe gave him the year Will carved his first and only canoe. Lolly Reed was not the kind of girl we expected Will to fall for. We always thought he'd team up with the kind of girls he dated in high school. Outdoorsy, political girls. Earnest girls who were often pretty but unpolished. As disorganized and flighty as Lolly could be, she was polished. More beautiful than pretty. She had long blonde hair and was stylish in a New York City kind of way. She read books, but not about Indian massacres or fracking in the Catskills. She read novels, modern ones about families and secrets and love. She spoke French and Italian and knew a lot about contemporary art from her mother, who ran galleries in New York and London. After college, Lolly worked in the photo department of a fashion magazine in New York. She was sophisticated culturally, but not politically, and was the kind of girl who we thought was invisible to Will. They met on a study abroad program in Mexico sponsored by Vassar the spring semester of their junior year. Will went to Mexico because he was fascinated by the government's stewardship of the Mayan tribal culture, and he also wanted to refine his Spanish so that he could be a bilingual public defender. Lolly, on the other hand, decided at the last minute to follow her previous boyfriend into the program, but broke up with him a few days after they arrived after she met our son. She explained this to us the night we met her, at a small restaurant she and Will like to go to near their campus in Mexico City. Who knows what draws people together? Lolly seemed unformed to us, young. She was colorful and chatty, full of stories, but had few questions. She drew you in, but once you were there, you sensed she could vanish without warning. She had a way of telling two stories at once, looking behind you when she spoke. She seemed like someone who covered her bases, kept several balls in the air so she always knew she would have at least one in hand at the end of the day. She was clever, but not careful. She was, we recognized immediately, someone who could hurt our son. Around Lolly, he was fatherly, patient, mesmerized. We watched him sweep up tortilla crumbs that had fallen down and around the table in front of her during the meal. He did this not once, but three times. And as he did, she continued to talk, animate what she was saying with expressive eyes, passionate tones, and wild hand gestures, all the while absentmindedly spilling crumbs as she took bites of her food between words. 5 months after that dinner, from the Moonstone in Moclips, he called to tell us he had proposed. Lolly was the new Sissy, the new Joe Chenoa, the new Cause, the new Amherst. She was somewhere Mimi and Prue and Mike and I had not been and could not go. Will always had that knack for frontiers, even if they were in our own backyard. But marrying Lolly felt different, risky and final at the same time. They both still had their senior years to finish, and I'm ashamed to admit that Mimi and I hoped the distance between Amherst and Vassar would be far enough to make their engagement seem like a summer folly. It is true we never got to know her well. Prue spent a week with her before the wedding. She asked Will if it would be okay. She'd only met Lolly twice before, and she said she just wanted to be with them, help in whatever way she could. Prue called us each of those days before we flew east for the wedding. She said she was beginning to understand Will's connection with Lolly. Twice we patched Mike in on these phone calls. It was like we'd sent an explorer to the new world, and we hung on every word she used to describe what she saw and heard and how she felt. She described the old stone farmhouse where June and her boyfriend lived, the wide fields behind the house and the acres of trails on the Unification Church land which their property bordered. She described everyone. June's boyfriend Luke, who was much younger and she said beautiful. His mother Lydia, who was hard to get to know, a bit standoffish but not in an arrogant way, more like a hurt animal would be. And June, who she said reminded her of Will. Strong, competent, organized, but like Will, a little undone around Lolly, deferential, in awe. I remember the last call Prue made from that house. It was the night before we flew east. She would be joining us at the Betsy Motel once we arrived. Lolly's father was arriving in the morning, she told us, and there had been a fuss about where he was staying. Lolly had insisted he sleep at the house with them, and June, that afternoon, asked her to reconsider. It led to a big fight, and Lolly, of course, won. But before it was over, it got heated, and Prue went for a walk to clear her head and get a little distance from the tension. Later, on the way back to the house, she said she found June sitting on a fallen tree in the woods with her arms holding her sides, gently rocking. Prue didn't want to alarm her, but it was too late to walk away. When June saw her, she waved her over and wiped the tears from her face. Prue asked if she was okay, and June answered with a question that seemed to Prue more of a comment on June's struggles with Lolly. Did you ever have a family? Prue said she sounded completely wiped out, at wit's end. She asked June if she wanted to walk back with her to the house, but she politely declined, saying she needed to be alone a little while longer. Prue told us that night she'd never felt as grateful. That her answer to June's question had been yes, but not as a commiseration or an explanation of fatigue, as it seemed to be for June, but both as an acknowledgement of great fortune and a prayer of thanks. with Mike on the line from Tacoma, and Mimi and I huddled over her iPhone on speaker in the kitchen, Prue whispered to us, "Thank you." Kelly. It's a relief to finally find where you're meant to be. I always thought it was Seattle. I was born there. I grew up there. I met Rebecca and lived with her there for more than 15 years. I never questioned where I was supposed to be. But from time to time I got curious. Or maybe I was just restless for something new. I remember reading up on Provincetown, Massachusetts in the year or so before I met Rebecca. Never got there, but it looked like a place to live. I even made a few phone calls about hotel jobs. But aside from summer business, there isn't much in the way of hotel management. Holiday Inn had been good to me, and, then, it was unimaginable to leave Seattle for a job that wasn't with them. The nearest they had on the Cape was almost an hour from Provincetown, closer to Boston, which was no place that interested me. It always seemed to me like an East Coast Seattle, but with more colleges and universities. Acres of Irish in both places, which is what I am and who I'm from. Few people are from where we are now. Moclips has less than 200 year-round residents, and one way or another Sissy's family is related to most all of them. Not that Sissy has ever told us a thing about any of them or herself. Whatever we know about her, we've pieced together from her sisters, who clammed up quick, or folks in Aberdeen who are not exactly what you'd call loose-lipped, especially about one of their own, to a couple of city dykes who will always, no matter how long we're here, be outsiders. Sissy is either a mystery or the opposite, all shadow or light. Either way, she lets us know what she wants known, and the rest is none of our business. She goes her way, we go ours, and we coexist as employer and employee. Still, every so often she'll surprise you. Like a few months ago when a film crew from a cable show set up cameras just down from the Moonstone. It was quite a production. They ran cords from generators in our parking lot out to the beach and parked a food truck alongside the road to feed the cast and crew. For days they filmed underwater divers walking in and out of the surf and shot footage of actresses dressed in mermaid costumes, fanning their rubber tails in the waves. There were 5 girls, all young, late teens, early 20s, and they stood shivering in bathrobes between takes, chain-smoking. On one of the nights, things got rowdy in room 5. The crew guys and the actresses were whooping it up, and we got calls not only from the guests in one of the 2 rooms not occupied by people from the TV show, but from the Sweeneys, the retired couple who live next door, who have never once complained to us. It was just past 10 at night when they called. Rebecca and I were watching an episode of some British TV series on DVD. So I hit pause, put on my boots and coat, grabbed my flashlight, and headed for where the noise was coming from. I could smell pot smoke long before I reached the door, and hear loud reggae music broken by the occasional burst of screaming laughter. As I approached the door, I could see the door to room 6 open. I expected Jane to appear. But instead it was Sissy, wearing her Carhartt canvas jacket buttoned to the top and her long silver braid tucked inside. Someone who didn't know her might have seen a tall, stern-looking man emerge from the door of one motel room and step quickly to the door of another. Sissy did not bother knocking, but instead pulled out her master key and opened the door right up. I could hear her yell, "Out!" just the one time. Right away, the music stopped. I stepped back to the side of the building to watch. I don't know why, but I didn't want Sissy to see me. One by one, the girls began to stumble out, some alone, others with guys from the crew. Eventually, everyone made it back to their rooms. Once Sissy was satisfied, she walked down the path toward the office and turned left onto Pacific Avenue toward her sister's house. Had Jane called Sissy? Or had Sissy been in Jane's room when the racket started? I stood in the shadows of the motel building wondering whether to check in on Jane or call Sissy. Neither seemed right. So I walked toward the beach and watched the waves crash for a little while. The moon was not visible that night, so the only light came from the motel, the few houses along the beach, and farther down where 109 cuts close to the sand, the dim and infrequent twitch of headlights. I tried to imagine how it was 200 years ago, when only the Quinault tribe walked the beach. Sissy's sister Pam told us this land was where the tribe brought their teenage girls to be safe after they reached puberty and before they married. Who guarded them? I wondered. Surely not men, the very thing the girls were being protected from. I wondered, too, how many of them never married, either by bad luck or by choice. Did they have a choice then? I doubted it. Did those women stay on and help protect the younger girls? Or were they sent back to the tribe at some unmarriageable age to live out the rest of their years as spinsters? Local legend has it that one night all the sleeping girls were swallowed by the sea. Rebecca and I have heard at least a half a dozen variations on the tale. One involves a sea witch who cast a spell, another a falling star that crashed into the ocean and caused a mighty tidal wave, and one starts with a terrible fire that drove the animals from the hills into the ocean, carrying the girls with them in the stampede. But in every version of the story, the sleeping girls end up underwater, where they somehow transform into mermaids, enchanted protectors, whose magic keeps the Quinault virgins from harm. No doubt some scrap of this story must have made its way to the producers making the silly television show. I walked toward the water to make out the shape of the waves in the pitch-black night. The wind was rough, and I pulled my turtleneck up above my face just below my eyes. I stood a few feet from the surf and imagined the chain-smoking actresses as real-life mermaids, gorgeous and fierce, their scales shining. Who wouldn't want to be protected by such creatures? I thought of Penny and Rebecca, who looked after each other as kids and later too as adults. For most of their lives, they only had each other. I always had older brothers and cousins and uncles. And even though my being gay was not anyone's first choice, including mine initially, after I came out in high school, anyone who made fun of me, or worse, was swiftly dealt with by my family. After a while, because they had to, the kids in my school accepted me. I wasn't prom queen or anything, but I was co-captain of the field hockey team, vice president of my senior class, and I organized a volunteer soup kitchen on the weekends my junior and senior years. What I'm saying is that I wasn't on my own. I felt different, unsure of how to make my way romantically, but I felt safe. My family gave me that. And the older I get, the more I see how lucky I was. All but one of my brothers moved east. My parents aren't around anymore, and I have one uncle in a nursing home in Olympia. Rebecca is my family now. She has me, and I have her, and it's where we belong. Penny didn't have anyone the night she died. No mermaids, no Rebecca. Before that night on the beach, I had never considered just how alone Penny must have felt, how completely on her own in that danger she was. I turned back toward the Moonstone and started walking home. The only lights on now were from room 6. Jane. Probably the most alone person I've ever met. I'd seen plenty of lonely travelers at the Holiday Inn in Seattle, and even here. But no one like Jane, who seemed half in the world and half out of it. She has been, in the few times I've actually seen and spoken with her, nearly without life. Still, she has Sissy. How exactly we do not know, but it is clear she has in her a formidable ally. I wonder if she sees it that way, is aware of how far this stranger has taken her under her wing. A few weeks after Jane checked in, Rebecca and I noticed that Sissy was coming and going from room 6 just a little bit more than was usual. We then began to see her carrying around a giant green thermos, the kind you see on camping trips with a big silver screw-off top that doubles as a bowl or cup, depending on what's inside. We'd never seen her with it before, but not long after Jane checked in, we saw that thermos in Sissy's hands most days. Rebecca and I eventually pieced together that she was dropping it off at room 6 in the morning when she started cleaning the rooms, and picking it up at the end of the day. At first, Jane would leave it outside the door on the cement stoop. But after a while, we noticed that Sissy would step inside to pick it up, usually for only a minute or two, but occasionally for longer. This business with the thermos has been going on for over 7 months. What those two could possibly speak about or have in common, I can't imagine. And I'll admit, at first it irked me to be excluded from whatever bond they'd developed. But now when I see Sissy heading to room 6 with that giant green thermos, I just think, thank God that sad woman pulled up to our motel, and not some other godforsaken place. Thank God she has someone to look out for her. Thank God any of us do. Lydia. He's explained it all before, and it still makes no sense. In that voice of his that rises and falls and swoops like a song. You are a lucky lady, Lydia Mori. Lucky indeed. This lottery you have won is over $3 million and is only awarded once every 2 years. At times she does not hear a word he is saying, just his voice. She has fallen asleep with the phone cradled between her ear and shoulder. His voice a lullaby spinning tales of millions. The prize, he says, has never before been given to an American, and technically it cannot be. But Winton is offering to help her, putting himself on the line to steer her through the red tape so she can receive her money. This, he says with an ocean of warmth in his voice, is what I will do for you. Sometimes she hangs up on him, leaves the receiver off the hook and turns out the light. But he always calls the next day, usually between 9 and 10 in the morning, and then again after 6 o'clock, after she's mailed her bills, shopped for her groceries, toilet paper, cans of Progresso soup, English muffins, and had her coffee at the coffee shop. Often, when she is unlocking the door to the apartment, she hears the phone ringing. The few times it hasn't, she's been disappointed. It's a scam, and she knows it. He is flirtatious and personal, warm and bullying, and she understands that she is being drawn in, manipulated, made dependent. She knows all this, but she still picks up the phone. Occasionally, like a teenager who tells her mother to tell the boy she has a crush on that she's not home when he calls, she will let it ring. But she will pick up the next day, and she knows it. Winton knows it, too, because he always calls again. Lydia Mori, I missed you yesterday. You must have been out cutting a rug or breaking some poor boy's heart. After a month of the calls and the talk of prize money and red tape and risk, Winton begins to apply a little pressure, set a clock to the proceedings. The $3 million will go to someone else if she does not pay the international prize taxes. The first tax is $750, pennies compared to what she will have, and it is the sum the prize committee reimburses. They would pay it directly for her, but it's not allowed. She must pay first, and then the committee will send her that amount right away. Paying this tax, Winton says without music, is necessary to continue. She pays. She drives to Walmart in Torrington, puts $750 on a money card, as Winton suggested, and mails it to an apartment in Astoria, Queens, where a designated representative from the lottery lives. Walmart, Queens, money cards, reimbursements. She is amazed he thinks she will believe any of it. And still she's not ready to step away. Not prepared just yet to come home in the evening each night knowing there will be no phone call. As well, there is also a thin, far-off hope that somehow the ludicrous scenario Winton has described is true. She has even allowed herself the fantasy of sending him money after she wins to pay for his schooling, to help him support his family. But it's all a farce, and she knows it will expire, or she will end it soon, but not just yet. So she allows herself to think of the $750 as a test. A test she knows he will fail, and because he will, the farce will end, and all will return to being as it was. She deliberately does not think this through, actively protects herself from recognizing how wasteful this is. She will see this to its end, and she does not ask herself why. And so she puts the money card in an envelope addressed to Theodore Bennett in Astoria, Queens, the prize official Winton mentioned. Winton also told her there should be no note inside and no return address on the envelope. And though the idea of $750 floating out there without a return address is intolerable, she still complies and drops the untraceable envelope in the mailbox in front of the town hall. In the days that follow, the calls from Winton continue, and she settles back into their established routine. A morning call she mostly avoids, an evening call she takes. She listens to him talk about his last girlfriend, who cheated on him and left him crushed. The son she never lets him see, his sick mother, his sister in jail. His world blinks to life over these calls. He is a jilted boyfriend, a dutiful and worrying son. He is 28, he says. He is taking classes at night to get a degree in accounting so he can quit his job with the lottery, which pays poorly and is only part-time. He would have quit months ago, but he'd like to steer this year's prize to Lydia before he goes. Just do this one last thing because he'd like to see a good woman like Lydia get the money, not some European asshole, the type who usually takes the prize. Over time, his sister in jail becomes his cousin, his aunt, his niece. The class at night is for engineering, for hotel management, for graphic design. The girlfriend's name is Carla, Nancy, Tess, Gloria. He is 28, 24, 30. The inconsistencies alarm Lydia at first and then amuse. Further proof that she's right, that the whole thing is a hoax. But then Winton begins to ask again about her life. Questions he asked in the beginning, but she deflected. Is she married? What does she do for work? Does she have children? And now, because something else must begin on these phone calls for them to continue, she tells him about Earl Morey, her ex-husband, the red-headed boy who was a lot of fun, and then none at all, who called her snacks and pinched her leg and butt and left small purple and yellow bruises, who knocked her in the head with a phone book one night so hard it made her lose her balance the whole next day, who stayed at the tap with his brothers and cousins and uncles most nights and would come home drunk and, if she was lucky, sleep on the couch of their small apartment. She was 19 and married, and within the year she hated him and his whole family and she could do nothing. When she finally confessed what was going on to her mother, she told her daughter to zip it and be grateful she'd found a man from a good family. She tells all this to Winton, and as she talks about this time, it's as if she's reading a bedtime story to her son when he was a boy, about a girl who made the wrong turn in the forest and had no way out. She talks and talks, just as Winton had in the beginning, and she hears him breathing on the other end of the phone. Only rarely does he ask a question or comment on anything she said. And if he does, it is punctuation and no more. What a fool, that stupid man, he has said. A drunken fool. She does not mention other men, the ones who pursued her until they slept with her and then stopped calling. Nor does she mention Rex, and Luke, she says nothing about him. 10 days after she mails the letter, a padded manila envelope with a Newark, New Jersey postmark arrives, and in it are $700 bills and a 50. No note, no paper of any kind, just the money. Later that day, she tucks the roll of bills in the pocket of her fleece pullover and walks to the coffee shop. It is early February, but Christmas decorations are still taped to the windows. They are the kind you buy at the drugstore or the supermarket. Thin, cardboard Santas, plate-sized snowflakes, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Along the ceiling and the top of the windows are strung small white lights, and on the counter by the register is a miniature artificial Christmas tree wrapped in a silver garland with a plastic angel on top. The money in Lydia's pocket gives her an unfamiliar energy, a lift. She knows it's hers, that she's been given nothing, won nothing, but still the large bills and the way they arrived give her a surge. She drinks her coffee quickly, and when the check comes, she pays with the 50. The waitress, Amy, who now looks like she is well into her 8th month, picks up the bill and returns the change without comment or any evidence of interest. Lydia leaves a $5 tip, pulls on her fleece jacket, and starts home. Before she reaches the sidewalk, she notices a boy in a green sweatshirt circle the parking lot on his bike and cross in front of her. She's seen him before, hanging out on the green with his friends, smoking. He worked for Luke, but dozens of kids in Wells between the ages of 13 and 22 worked for Luke at one time or another. What did June call them? Pickpockets and potheads? Lydia winces at the memory of June's teasing, and watches the boy swoop in tight circles with his bike. Could this be Kathleen Riley's boy? She wonders, and imagines what he's heard his mother spewing about her. Lydia reminds herself that Kathleen's name is no longer Riley, that it's been Moore for many years. Kathleen married a contractor from Kent who built her a big house on Wildy Road, and was a nurse at the hospital before she started having kids. Funny, Lydia thinks, to think of Kathleen Riley as a nurse and a mother. Her sharpest memory of Kathleen is from high school, when she accused Lydia of stuffing her bra. Lydia was the first in her seventh grade class to noticeably need a bra, and so by the time she entered high school, she was more developed than any of the other girls her age. On the second day of high school, she was given the nickname Lactadia. No one claimed credit for the name, but it stuck. And soon the older boys were writing her lewd notes and slipping them into her locker, asking to go for a walk behind the bleachers at school, catcalling when she got on the bus. "I'm thirsty," they'd yell from the back seat in the mornings, and in the afternoon from the open windows once she got off at the bus stop at the end of the town green. By the second week of school, many of the girls in the higher grades, Kathleen Riley among them, took a fierce dislike to Lydia. Being younger than Kathleen by 2 years, Lydia had been invisible to her in elementary school. Now that they were in high school, Kathleen not only saw her, she waged war against her. "Lactadia has no milk," was her favorite chant. And in the stairwell once, between classes, she and her friends cornered Lydia. Kathleen demanded she lift her shirt to prove she wasn't stuffing her bra with tissues. Lydia was so frightened that instead of walking away, or telling Kathleen to fuck off, she slowly lifted her blouse above her head and exposed her very real breasts. Lydia remembers standing there, shirt up, covering her face, hearing kids pass her on the stairs and one of them grabbing her right breast and squeezing it hard. She couldn't see whose hand it was, and she was too stunned to respond. By the time she lowered her blouse, Kathleen and the others had turned away and were rushing down the stairs. Lydia could hear the word, "Freak!" echo as they descended in a storm of cackling laughter. There were other humiliations and thousands of half-heard whispers, but the memory of being exposed and mauled before the accusing eyes of Kathleen Riley and her friends is the most mortifying. Not until the older girls had graduated and Lydia began dating Earl, who was popular and feared and came with a force field of protection, did the terror she felt approaching school each day begin to lift. Now, every few weeks or so, Lydia will see Kathleen coming down the aisle at the grocery store, or standing in line at the pharmacy. And when she does, she is always careful to keep her head down and avoid eye contact. As if they were still in high school, she gets out of the way, becomes invisible. Lydia squints to get a better look at the boy on the bike, though still can't be sure he's Kathleen's son. She's always known most people in town, but once Luke was out of school and later, after Rex left and she stopped going out to the tap and places like it, she kept to herself and had little to do with anyone beyond those she worked for. Slowly, without noticing, she started losing track of the marriages and births, the breakups and new people. But this kid, she's noticed, and lately, too often. She remembers one of her mother's kitchen table wisdoms, which she'd typically trot out on the occasion of hearing some piece of local fallen from grace gossip. "Good apples get picked. It's the rotten ones that fall close to the tree." It never made sense to Lydia. It still doesn't. But it begins to as she watches up ahead, where the boy who is probably Kathleen Riley's son swerves off Main Street onto Low Road and disappears. Lydia walks faster, and in her coat pocket, crushes money in her fist. Silas. He ditches his bike behind a garbage shed on Low Road and cuts back through the field behind the elementary school to Herrick Road. At first, she is out of sight, 7 or 8 driveways ahead. But soon he is close enough to see her arms swing at her sides. Her jeans pockets ride the wild movement of her ass. It's been like this for months. She walks, he follows, closer and closer, narrowing the gap between them each time. Lately, he's been close enough to see the faint outline of panties and bra straps behind her clothes. He'd heard from someone that Luke's mom was in her 50s, but as he watches her ass rock back and forth and jiggle up and down in her tight jeans, he thinks, no fucking way. He's seen it in shorts, sweatpants, tight skirts, loose skirts, and many times and most often in jeans that look like these. Lydia Mori walks a lot, mostly to the coffee shop, the bank, and the grocery store, and she walks as if she's stoned or in a trance of some kind. She never turns around, hardly ever looks to either side. He's pretty sure she has not seen him, even once, in the weeks and months that have passed since he started following her. He rushes his pace to get closer. That ass. He's spellbound by the metronomic perfection of its movement. Up, down, down, up. And thinks, this is no mom's ass. He winces, ashamed by his racing mind, regretting this particular thought. His gaze pulls back to take in the rest of her. He sees her hands, her ringless fingers, her wrists, her worn sneakers, the dark brown hair piled on her head tumbling in loose strands down around her shoulders. For the first time, he sees a few gray hairs. With these, she becomes again a whole person, not just a few thrilling body parts. She returns to being the reason he parks his bike 4 doors down from her apartment on Upper Main Street in the mornings before work in the summer, and on Saturdays now that school has started up again. She becomes, again, his dead boss's mom, Lydia Mori. The woman people in town talk about. The woman he's heard described as the mother of the crackhead whose negligence blew up a house and killed 3 people and himself. The sex-mad slut who cheated on Earl Mori with a migrant worker, a drug dealer, a hitchhiker, a Zulu tribesman. The mother of the hustler who conned June Reed into being his sugar mama until she threw him out and he came back on a suicide mission. The monster who gave birth to a bad seed, who finally got what was coming to him. He's heard it all and has kept quiet every time. The only remotely nice thing he's ever heard said about Lydia Mori was that she had the best rack in Litchfield County. His father made the comment this summer as they waited at a stop sign in town and she crossed in front of them wearing a tan halter top. Not even the young girls at the tap can compete with that, he added. Silas's mother, who never liked Lydia Mori, was not in the car. When her name was mentioned in their house, she was always quick to comment that Lydia was someone for whom she had no use. She also said, after getting off the phone with one of her friends a few days after everything happened, I suppose no one ever told Lydia that when you lie down with dogs, you not only get fleas, you get pregnant with more dogs. How June Reed ever got mixed up with that mutt son of hers, I'll never know. Even through this, Silas stayed silent. The only time he ever spoke about any of it was when he was questioned by the police and the fire marshal about working at June Reed's the day before the wedding. They came to the door of his house that night, and he sat in the kitchen and told them the same thing Ethan and Charlie told them. That Luke had them do what he usually had them do for New Yorkers like June Reed. Pick up twigs and sticks, pull weeds from the sidewalk, and edge the flower beds. The only difference was that Luke paid everyone in advance that day and doubled their regular $12 an hour. As he was handing out their cash, he asked them to do twice as good a job as usual. You guys are good, but today I need great. Silas told the police officers that Luke had said this, but they didn't seem interested. They kept asking about Luke's mood, whether he seemed drunk or high or upset when they saw him last. Silas said he seemed like he always seemed. A little stressed out, busy, but fine. He told them that he and the other guys showed up at June Reed's place around 2 that day, and Luke worked alongside them for the first couple of hours. He rode the John Deere, mowing the front and back lawns while Ethan, Charlie, and Silas did everything else. Around 4 o'clock, Luke said he had errands to run, so he left them to finish working until 6:30, after which Charlie and Ethan piled into Ethan's old Saab and Silas rode his bike down Indian Pond Road to his house, which was less than a mile away. What none of them told the cops was that not long after Luke left, the three of them booked across the field behind the house to the trails that led to the Unification Church property. What kids in town called the moon, because as everyone knew, the Unification Church was just another name for the Moonies. They did not say that they had sprinted to the moon and took turns pooling from Silas's bong. They also did not say that it turned out all three had a stash, so they mixed a little from each into the bowl and smoked what Charlie called, sarcastically, a wedding salad. They lost track of time on the moon, and when they got back, it was almost six. After Silas ditched his yellow knapsack inside the stone shed outside the kitchen, the three of them rushed through the rest of the work and left before dark. By then, the driveway was packed with cars and the house was full for the rehearsal dinner, so they took off without saying anything to Luke, who they assumed was pissed that they were nowhere to be seen when he returned. They also didn't want him to clock that they were high. Before leaving, Silas remembers he saw Lydia inside the screen porch. She was sitting with June on the wicker sofa, laughing, small candles all around them flickering on tables holding flowers and food. He cannot remember anything more about seeing these two women, but he remembers clearly the sweet smell of freshly cut lawn, the sound of tent fabric slapping the air, and the first streaks of sunset painting the sky pink. These were the seconds before he left for home, and he has replayed each one a million times. It is hard to believe the woman on the porch that night in May is the same one walking with grim purpose ahead of him now, bundled in a purple fleece, trudging across Herrick Road to Upper Main Street. Not once since that night has he seen her smile or heard her laugh. Silas slows down to let a gap expand between them. He wonders if Lydia even knows who he is. He'd worked for Luke on and off for three summers and on weekends in the fall and spring. He wonders if she saw him that day at June Reed's. He remembers standing by the stone shed and rushing away when he heard Luke's voice coming from the kitchen. He remembers running toward the driveway and flying on his bike along the green cornfields that stretch from the edge of June Reed's property, past the church where June's daughter was getting married the next day. He slowed down when he came upon Indian Pond, reflecting the red and purple sunset stretching above him. He remembers fireflies blinking from the brush and woods on both sides of the road as he pedaled. He remembers stopping to crawl down the rocky slope to the water's edge to take a leak, the wild sky and the surface of the pond still as glass until his piss sent it rippling. The effect was trippy, and especially so since he was still high. At one point, the cloud shifted, and above him spread what looked like a great dragon with wings as wide as the world. Silas stumbled back from the lake as the creature came into view, jaws jagged with teeth and blasting fire, smoke curling from its snout, magnificent wings expanding in scales of cloud, its gigantic tail twisting past the horizon. It was a spectacular beast, its eyes the only visible blue. Long slits that appeared to widen as its head turned slowly toward Silas where he sat against the bank, dazzled and afraid. All these months later, he had forgotten about the dragon, and how, for a few terrifying seconds, he believed it was real. He'd forgotten that it was dark by the time he found his way up the bank to the road, and how at first he could not find his bike. He thinks about those moments when he stumbled in the dark before finding his bike, which had fallen down next to the tree he'd leaned it against earlier. He wishes he could return to that stumbling, to that perfectly blind minute before he knew anything. Not where his bike was, not what would happen later that night or the next morning. Not that a full moon would soon rise and light the whole valley, or that later, after everyone in his family had gone to sleep, he'd scramble back onto his bike to pedal furiously down this same road, counting on the light of the moon to guide his way to June Reed's house. Without noticing, he has quickened his pace and closed the gap between him and Lydia. After crossing Herrick onto the sidewalk that runs the length of Upper Main Street, he forgets he's supposed to remain hidden. What had only minutes before been at least three or four car lengths has now collapsed to only a few yards. When he realizes how close he is, he knows he should slow his pace to a quiet halt and bank left down one of the driveways out of sight. But he's never been this close before. He thinks he can hear her breathing. The air is cold, but he can see perspiration beading on the back of her neck. She has taken off her fleece, and he can see patches of skin through the sweat-soaked cloth of her white T-shirt. His eyes move from one patch of almost exposed skin to another. He leans closer. His shoe scuffs the pavement, scrapes loudly against the loose sand, and for the first time he can see her register his presence. His other foot accidentally kicks a twig that hits the back of her ankle, and she stops abruptly, turns around. He freezes. She is inches away. June. After the maze of rock-strewn, erosion-destroyed dirt roads leading away from Bowman Lake, the smooth asphalt of Route 93 south of Kalispell is a relief. When she sees the sign for Butte, she drifts toward the exit for Interstate 90 and later takes another exit when she sees the sign for Salt Lake City. A few miles into Idaho, she can feel the wagon pulling to the left. It gets worse. So she gets off at the next exit, and by the time she finds a Texaco, she can barely keep the car moving in a straight line. The kids at the register have no idea how to change a tire. The place is more of a grocery store that happens to sell gas than a gas station where anyone knows anything about cars. She waits for someone to pull in who looks like they know what to do. Soon, an older guy with a thick head of white hair and closely trimmed beard, wearing a red flannel shirt, backs his truck up to a pump. When she asks him if he knows how to change a tire, the amused look on his face makes it clear she's picked the right guy. He puts out his hand and says, "Brody Cook, reporting for duty." She shakes his hand but says nothing. "All right then," he says, still cheerful. He smiles and finishes pumping and paying for his gas. After he pulls his truck away from the pumps and parks next to the Subaru, he asks where she keeps the spare, and she says she isn't sure the wagon has one. "One of two places," he says, "heads or tails." He looks at her expectantly, and she has no idea how to respond. "Okay, let's try heads." He pops the hood, and after one quick look around the engine says, "Tails it is." When he steps to the back of the wagon and opens the hatch, she hears him ask where she'd like him to put the bags. He asks again. When she doesn't answer, he walks around the car with a suitcase in one hand and a duffel bag in the other and puts them down on the asphalt. "I'll leave you in charge of these," he says before returning to extract the spare tire from under the panel beneath the rug. They had been with her all along, shoved in the back of the Subaru, packed and ready and forgotten. Is it possible, she wonders, that she hasn't opened the hatch since she started driving? She's had no reason to go back there. She brought nothing with her, acquired nothing on the way besides the toothbrush and paste she picked up at a gas station in Pennsylvania the first day. How long has it been? A week? Two? She lost track of time almost as soon as she left Connecticut. Even now she can't remember how many nights she slept in the wagon next to Bowman Lake. 3 nights? 4? She stayed until the bottles of water and bags of peanuts and raisins she'd stocked up in Ohio ran out. However long she's been on the road, these bags have been with her the whole time. It is obvious who belonged to each one. Will's is a sleek arrangement of zippers and pockets with wheels and collapsible handle. Lolly's is a frayed olive canvas duffel with taped leather straps and ink stains. Lolly would never have been so organized as to pack everything the night before and have the bags waiting in the car. This was Will's handiwork. Will was the son-in-law Adam always dreamed of. The kind of guy to read up on infectious diseases in foreign countries before traveling there, who paid all of his bills on time, filled the coffee maker with water and ground beans and set the timer the night before. The kind of guy to make sure the bags for his honeymoon in Greece were packed and waiting in his mother-in-law's car the night before his wedding. June can hear him walking Lolly through the schedule. Wedding at 1, reception from 2 to 6, out the door and in June's car by 7 so that June and Luke would get them to Kennedy Airport no later than 9:30 for their 11:45 flight to Athens. He even emailed the itinerary to Lolly, Adam, his parents, and Luke and June so that no one was unclear when everything needed to occur. Lolly's duffel is only half-zippered, and at one end, sticking out just a few inches, June sees the edge of a pale blue towel. Brody turns the jack to raise the front left corner of the car, and she feels like walking away. From him, the car, the bags, the towel. As she steps back, quietly, one foot slowly behind the other, she hears Lolly calling to Will. Wait, I forgot my vitamins. This is after the rehearsal, after the dinner, after Luke has cleaned up the mess from making chili for everyone, after Adam has gone to bed and Lydia, a little tipsy, has gone home. June is at the kitchen table sorting neglected piles of mail. Wait, Lolly calls from her room after Will is already out the front door with the bags. She slams down the back stairs like she always has, loud and fast and sounding like an avalanche. She flies out the door in bare feet, clutching in both hands a light blue towel from the upstairs bathroom she's made into a makeshift satchel for her bottles of vitamins. Come back, I have no shoes. June hears them laughing just outside the house and thinks, with a loose knot of nostalgia and envy, that this moment in their relationship, in their lives, is as good as it will ever get. The before. The top of the Ferris wheel, a man she went on a date with in London once told her as they rode above the city in the newly opened Eye. This blind date was arranged by a pushy but well-intentioned colleague at the gallery. The man was her colleague's uncle and a widower, and for both of them it was too soon. Most of that evening had faded from memory. But when they reached the top of the great wheel and saw the golden lights of London fan out in gorgeous chaos below, she remembers him explaining his theory with an exhausted patience she had gotten used to in English men. This is the pivot between youth and age, the thrilling place where everything seems visible, feels possible, where plans are made. On the one side you have childhood and adolescence, which are the murky ascent, and on the other you have the decline, that is adulthood, old age, the inch-by-inch reckoning of that grand, brief vision with earthbound reality. Listening to Lolly and Will whisper and giggle outside, she imagines them swinging in a golden seat atop a Ferris wheel. She lets the image linger. She has not opened any of the mail spread out before her on the table. She pictures London that night, a maze of light stretching glamorously in every direction. She sees Lolly there, above it all, laughing. She pushes around the bills and letters, absentmindedly arranging them by shape and color. Then she hears Lolly calling to her from the still-open front door to come and unlock the wagon. It is chilly, and she puts her linen jacket on, and when she does, feels in the left pocket the card Luke borrowed earlier to get cash to pay the kids he'd hired to fix up the lawn. She grabs the keys from the brass tray she usually tosses them in and goes out to the driveway to open the car for Will. When they return, Lolly is barefoot on the front mat in her ratty sweatpants, elegant blouse still on from the evening, waiting for the two of them to come back inside. She is laughing her goofy laugh. When she sees June in the floodlight beams in front of the house, she calls out, "Mom!" ridiculously, without thinking, like a teenager with an easy relationship with her mother. The top of the Ferris wheel is a giddy and thoughtless place, June thinks, and so briefly enjoyed. When she gets to the front steps, she hugs her daughter for as long as she will let her. They go inside and Luke makes chamomile tea. The four of them sit on the screened porch talking about the rehearsal earlier and the chili and deviled egg dinner. Will is teasing Lolly about being late to the church the next day, losing the ring, and flubbing her vows. Feeling unusually playful with Lolly, June chimes in about how as a kid she'd been in the bathroom when she was meant to make her one brief appearance in Babes in Toyland, the school play in 8th grade. The talk is jolly, the teasing gentle, but gradually Lolly becomes quiet as if she suddenly realized she's dropped her guard and forgotten to maintain a safe distance. She recedes, and the talk moves on to Will's upcoming second year in law school, what he'll do once he's graduated, internships, clerkships, jobs. After a while, and out of nowhere, Lolly asks Luke if he is going to ask her mother to marry him. All talk stops. No jest is in her voice, no play at all. Luke meets her eyes and her tone. "I have, but your mother doesn't take the question seriously, or me seriously. Hard to tell which. At first I thought she blew it off because of you, but now that you're older and out of college and practically married, I'm beginning to wonder. Lately I've been hoping all this wedding stuff would rub off on her, but it hasn't. So the answer to your question is yes, and the answer to mine, asked twice, is no." This isn't the response Lolly expects. No one does, including, by the look on his face, Luke. The only sound is the dishwasher humming in the kitchen, and the impenetrable sound of the cicadas, which has graduated from an electric buzz to a droning roar. After a few uncomfortable seconds, Lolly stands and pulls Will with her. They leave the porch as Will apologetically says goodnight for both of them. "See you in the morning," he calls from the top of the stairs, before Lolly's bedroom door slams shut. They are gone. A long flatbed stacked high with sheets of plywood bangs loudly by. June is walking against traffic, head down, past the Arby's, the Taco Bell, the Exxon. She sees Luke's shoes, the brown, buckled ones he bought from one of her mail-order catalogs just for the wedding. They are shined perfectly, but on them she can see drops of tomato that must have fallen when he was cooking dinner. Tiny thatches of freshly mown grass whisker from the edges of the soles. A small clump falls on the bluestone as Luke nervously kicks at the leg of the wicker coffee table. Neither has spoken since Lolly and Will went upstairs to bed. Luke continues to fidget, and she can see white gym socks peeking out from his khaki trousers. His hand moves to her leg. His thumb begins to rub her thigh before she pushes it off and gets up to leave. He reaches for her hand, and in smacking it away, she grazes his cheek with her nail just below his left eye. He winces and pulls away. She does not apologize, does not stop to see if she's drawn blood, does not hesitate as she steps from the porch into the kitchen. Over the sound of passing cars, she hears someone calling. "Lady! Lady!" She knows she should stop, but the feeling is far away. She is at the sink filling the kettle with water to boil for more chamomile tea. Her hands are shaking. She wishes she could return to how it was earlier in the day. Everything until now had gone on without incident. Even with Adam, who arrived in the morning from Boston, alone and without a girl, thank God. June had, at the last minute, tried to persuade Lolly how much easier it would be on everyone if he stayed at the Betsy, where Will's family and others were staying. But her response was instant and volcanic, and despite June's delicate approach and stated worries, Adam was installed in the guest bedroom upstairs. Still, he'd been friendly to Luke, which was out of character and surprising, given how he'd behaved when they met last year at Lolly's graduation from Vassar. Adam refused to acknowledge Luke, and all afternoon muttered "cradle robber" and "cougar" under his breath. Regrettably, June responded on his level and reminded Adam that he'd been raiding the nursery long before their marriage was over. She remembers how quiet Luke became, and how only later that night did she see the afternoon through his eyes, two middle-aged, bitter exes pointing fingers at each other for dating younger people. It was humiliating. She swore she'd avoid this kind of squabbling at Lolly's wedding, and to her surprise, so far, it had required no effort. Adam had been respectful. No barbs, no bite. The last person she expected to upset the apple cart was Luke. But by letting Lolly rattle him as he had, he'd open up a can of worms she believed, or at least hoped, had been closed. The kettle is full, but she can't move it from beneath the faucet. It is overflowing, but the gushing water, the weight of it in her hand, is soothing. She has no idea what to do next, so she does nothing. She feels cornered and angry and wrong. She wishes she could return to the front walk just an hour or so ago, hear Lolly call to her when she saw her step into the beams of the floodlights. "Mom!" She wishes she could start the evening over from there, steer it away from where it is. She watches the steady flow of water from the faucet, how it spills from the top of the kettle and disappears down the drain. Cars whiz by. Horns wail. She is walking faster, but the voice is closer. "Lady, what on earth?" She begins to run, and soon someone grabs her arm. "Stop!" the voice shouts. "What the hell are you doing?" it asks, more bewildered than angry. She looks at the source, the beard, the flannel shirt, the white head of hair, but she does not see the man who helped her earlier. "I'm sorry," she says, "but not to this man." She is looking at the loose water, her trembling hands. "Oh, God, I'm so sorry," she says again, dropping to one knee and then the other. For the first time, far enough away and next to someone she does not know, she cries. George. I'd leave in the morning and the room would be a mess. Sheets and blankets twisted in knots, clothes and towels on the floor. But when I'd come back at night after a day at the hospital with Robert, the place would be impeccable. The bed